Geld takes into account the Soviets' evaluation of their belief about not only American nuclear power, but also American resolve. We can translate the Americans' belief in themselves. Fair enough. But what is happening on the side of American belief under Reagan? We are witnessing, on the one hand, an evolution of belief, on the other, an apparent rhetorical innovation, the choice of a new word, all of a sudden accompanied by a double hermeneutics, a private exegesis and a public one. It is a question of one single little word, to prevail. The word to prevail, whose weight, value, and presumed effects have at least as much importance as a given set of technological mutations that would on both sides be of such a nature as to displace the strategic basis of an eventual armed confrontation. You are better acquainted with the episode than I. I am referring to the policy defined in the document entitled Fiscal Year 1984-1988 Defense Guidance, Spring 82. A document according to which, in the course of a nuclear war of any length, the United States, quote, must prevail. This policy, adopted officially and secretly, was then publicly disavowed by Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, in two letters, August 82, July 83, quoted and discussed by Theodore Draper in Nuclear Temptations. Everything in January 84, everything apparently comes together in the public or private exegesis of what the word prevail may or must implicitly mean. Let us now follow the word belief in the interpretation Gelb proposes of that sequence of events. I quote Gelb in the New York Times. And I underline beliefs, the word belief. In the Reagan administration's apparent belief in being able to actually control a nuclear war once begun and to fight it over a period of perhaps months, doctrine has been carried beyond well-established bounds. Such a belief, could induce some leader someday to think, he could risk starting a nuclear war because he would be able to stop short of a complete catastrophe. But the Reagan administration went further still by reintroducing the 1950s idea of actually seeking to win a nuclear war. For the last 20 years, administrations have used words like preventing defeat or avoiding an unfavorable outcome to describe their belief that there could be no winners in a nuclear war. Following the uproar, always quoting Gelb, following the uproar caused by the secret use of the word prevail, Mr. Weinberger stated that, quote, Gelb quotes Weinberger, that nowhere, said Weinberger, nowhere in all this do we mean to imply that nuclear war is winnable. This notion had no place in our strategy. We see nuclear weapons only as a way of discouraging the Soviets from thinking they could ever resort to them. end, end quote. This brings to light the proportional relation between the multiplicity of rhetorics and the multiplicity of supposed addresses, a private or a public dimension within the United States, American or non-American public opinion, American or Soviet decision makers, as if the Soviet adversaries were not capable, moreover, of immediately integrating all these variables into their own calculus. Mr. Chanenko has just denounced Reagan's rhetoric, that it is his own term, Chanenko's term, rhetoric. He denounced Reagan's rhetoric last week. And Gelb, too, uses the word rhetoric when he says, I quote, "The Reagan declaratory policy is quite consistent with past official rhetoric." But let us continue reading Gelb. Quote, "Mr. Reagan also issued denials. Nonetheless, the suspicion lingers that the leaders of the administration had something in mind in choosing that word. There are officials in this administration who have written and spoken of the likelihood of nuclear war and the need for the United States to prepare to fight, survive, and win it. How widely this view is shared in the administration is not clear. It's unclear. We have to make it clear. The unclear and the nuclear nuclear criticism has to make clear what is unclear in the administration's view. Go on quoting Gelb. "The charitable explanation, and the one that, and I underline this sentence, the one that squares most with my own experience with Reagan officials, is that prevailing to them really translates into the goal of gaining strategic nuclear superiority over the Soviet Union. Squares most with my own experience with Reagan officials, is that prevailing, the one that squares, is that prevailing to them really translates into the goal of gaining strategic nuclear superiority over the Soviet Union. Many of these officials helped to draft the 1980 Republican Party platform, which calls for achieving overall military and technological superiority over the Soviet Union. To many on the Reagan team, nuclear superiority is important, not because they are sanguine about fighting and winning a nuclear war, but because they believe that this kind of superiority is translatable into diplomatic power, and in the event of a crisis, into coercing the other side to back down. The idea is highly debatable, and I believe," says Gelb, "and I believe not supported by evidence." End quote. The idea is highly debatable, and I believe not supported by evidence. Gelb, whose name is a homonym for the name of the author of the first book to bear the word grammatology in its title, and it was also to give an account of this that I wrote of grammatology. Gelb believes then, I believe, he says, that there is no evidence, no proof. He believes that there are only beliefs. The Reagan belief is not based on proofs, but by definition, it could not be, for there are no proofs in this area. There is only one proof, that is war, and moreover, it proves nothing. The only thing the adverse discourse can oppose to the Reagan belief is another belief, its own hermeneutics, and its own rhetoric. I believe, writes Gelb. As for the translation into diplomatic power, translatable into diplomatic power. As for this translation of a new word prevailing, we might think at first that the word translation only has its broad, vague, and metaphorical meaning. It is a matter, indeed, of translating and of transporting a word to prevail into another realm, into diplomatic power, in the course of a non-linguistic transference. That much is indisputable. But the thing gets complicated nevertheless, as soon as one takes the following fact into account. Diplomatic power would not exist without the structure of a text. Of a text in the unlimited sense that I give the word, and of a text in the most strictly traditional sense of the term. There is only text in the diplomatic moment, that is, sophistical rhetoric of diplomacy. And you remember Clausewitz's statement on diplomacy and war. Fourth missive. As for the aporias of the nuclear referent, we don't believe in them. As for the aporias of the nuclear referent, we don't believe in them. Under the heading of nuclear criticism, in a colloquium organized by Diacritics, we have to talk about literature, about the literature that I shall distinguish here from poetry, from the epic, from belles lettres in general. Now it seems that the constitution of literature has not been possible without a project of stockpiling, of building up an objective archive over and above any traditional oral base. And two, without the development of a positive law implying author's rights, the identification of the signatory, of the corpus, names, titles, the distinction between the original and the copy, the original and the plagiarized version, and so forth. Literature is not reduced to this form of archivizing and this form of law, but it could not outlive them and still be called literature. Now, what allows us perhaps to think the uniqueness of nuclear war, it's being for the first time and perhaps for the last time, its absolute inventiveness. What it prompts us to think, even if it remains a decoy, a belief, a phantasmatic projection, is obviously the possibility of an irreversible destruction, leaving no traces. A destruction of the juridical literary archive, that is, total destruction of the basis of literature and criticism. Not necessarily the destruction of humanity, of the human habitat, nor even of other discourses, arts or sciences, not even indeed of poetry or the epic. These latter might reconstitute their living process and their archive, at least to the extent that the structure of that archive, that of a non-literary memory, the structure of that archive implies structurally reference to a real referent external to the archive itself. I'm taking care to say to that extent and on that hypothesis, it is not certain at all that all the other archives, whatever their material basis may be, have such a referent absolutely outside themselves, outside their own possibility. If they do have one, then they can rightfully reconstitute themselves and thus, in some other fashion, survive. But if they do not have one, or to the extent that they do not have one outside themselves, they find themselves in the situation of literature. One might say that they participate in literature. In that literature, in that fact, in the fact that to the extent that literature produces its referent, as a fictive or fabulous reference, which in itself is dependent on the possibility of archivizing, indeed constituted itself by the archivizing act. That would lead to a considerable extension, some would say an abusive one, of the field of literature. But who has proven that literature is a field with indivisible and simply assignable limits? The events known by the name of literature are definable, and there is in principle a possible history of this name and of the conventions attached to the naming. But the same cannot be said of the structural possibilities of what goes by the name literature, which is not limited to the events already known under this name. Here, we are dealing hypothetically with a total and reminderless destruction of the archive. This destruction would take place for the first time, and it would lack any common proportion with, for example, the burning of a library, even that of Alexandria, which occasioned so many written accounts and nourished so many literatures. The hypothesis of this total destruction watches over deconstruction. It guides its footsteps. It becomes possible to recognize, in the light, so to speak, of that hypothesis, or that fantasy, the characteristic structures and historicity of the discourses, strategies, texts, or institutions to be deconstructed. That is why deconstruction, at least what is being advanced today in its name, belongs to the nuclear age and to the age of literature. If literature is the name we give to the body of texts whose existence, possibility, and significance are the most radically threatened for the first and last time by the nuclear catastrophe, that definition allows our thought to grasp the essence of literature, its radical precariousness, and the radical form of its historicity. But at the same time, through literature is given to be thought out the totality of that which, like literature and henceforth in it, is exposed to the same threat, constituted by the same structure of historical fictionality, producing and then harboring its own referent. We may henceforth assert that the historicity of literature is contemporaneous through and through, or rather structurally indissociable from something like a nuclear epoch. By nuclear epoch, I also mean the epoche, suspending judgment before the absolute decision, what they call in Greek epoche. The nuclear age is not an epoch. It is the absolute epoche. It is not absolute knowledge and the end of history. It is the epoche of absolute knowledge. Literature belongs to this nuclear epoch, that of the crisis and of nuclear criticism. At least if we mean by this the historical and ahistorical horizon of an absolute self-destructibility without apocalypse, without revelation, without unveiling of its own truth, without absolute knowledge. This statement is not abstract. It does not concern general and formal structures, some equation between a literarity extended to any possible archive and a self-destructibility in general. No, according to my hypothesis, it would rather be a question of the sudden synchronous appearance of a cohabitation of two formations. On the one hand, we have the principle of reason, interpreted since the 17th century according to the order of representation, the domination of the subject-object structure, the metaphysics of will, modern technoscience, and so on. I refer here in passing to Heidegger, who, moreover, is less interested in nuclear war than in the atomic age as an age of information, which forms and informs a new figure of man. That is in the Ersatz von Grund. By the way, I would add this for Francis Fergusson. Heidegger reminds us the fact that Leibniz, who was the author of the formula for the principle of reason, was also supposed to be the inventor of insurance, as we know it. So, two formations. On the one hand, the principle of reason, with all its features, and on the other hand, we have the project of literature, in the strict sense, the project which cannot be shown to antedate the 17th or 18th centuries. To advance this hypothesis of their conjugation, it is not necessary to follow Heidegger in his interpretation of the principle of reason and in his evaluation of literature as distinguished from poetry, as it appears, for example, in Was heißt denken. But I have discussed this elsewhere, and I cannot pursue this direction further here. In what I am here calling, in another sense, an absolute epoch, literature comes to life and can only experience its own precariousness, its death minace, and its essential finitude. The movement of its expression, its inscription, is the very possibility of its effacement. Thus, one cannot be satisfied with saying that in order to become serious and interesting today, a literature and a literary criticism must refer to the nuclear issue, must even be obsessed by it. This has to be said, and it is true. But I believe also that, at least indirectly, they have always done this. Literature has always belonged to the nuclear epoch, even if it doesn't talk seriously about it. And in truth, I believe that the nuclear epoch is dealt with more seriously in text by Mallarmé or Kafka or Joyce, for example, than in present-day novels that would offer direct and realistic descriptions of a real nuclear catastrophe. Such would be the first version of a paradox of the referent. In two points. First, literature belongs to the nuclear age by virtue of the performative character of its relation to the referent and the structure of its written archive. Two, nuclear war has not taken place. It is a speculation, an invention in the sense of a fable, or an invention to be invented in order to make a place for it or to prevent it from taking place. And as much invention is needed for the one as for the other. And for the moment, all this is only literature. Some might conclude that therefore it is not real, as it remains entirely suspended in its fabulous and literary epoch. Fifth missive. But we do not believe, such is the other version of the other side of the same paradox, we do not believe in anything except the nuclear referent. We do not believe in anything except in the nuclear referent. If we are bound and determined to speak in terms of reference, nuclear war is the only possible referent of any discourse and any experience that would share their condition with that of literature. If, according to a structuring hypothesis or phantasm, fantasy, if nuclear war is equivalent to the total destruction of the archive, if not of the human habitat. It becomes the absolute referent, the horizon and the condition of all the others. An individual death, a destruction affecting only a part of society, of tradition, of culture, may always give rise to a symbolic work of mourning with memory, compensation, internalization, idealization, displacement, and so on. In that case, there is monumentalization, archivization, and work on the reminder, work of the reminder. Similarly, my own death, as an individual, so to speak, can always be anticipated phantasmatically, symbolically too, as a negativity at work, a dialectic of the work of a signature, name, heritage, image, grief. All the resources of memory and tradition can mute the reality of that death, whose anticipation then is still woven out of fictionality, symbolicity, or if you prefer, of literature. And this is so even if I live this anticipation in anguish, in terror, despair, as a catastrophe, that I have no reason not to equate with the annihilation of humanity as a whole. This catastrophe occurs with every individual death. There is no common measure adequate to persuade me that a personal mourning is less serious than a nuclear war. But the burden of every death can be assumed symbolically by a culture, by a social memory. That is even the essential function, their essential function, the function of culture and social memory. That is their justification, their raison d'être. Culture and memory limit the reality of individual death to this extent, and they soften or deaden it in the realm of, let's say, symbolic. The only reference that is absolutely real is thus of the scope or dimension of an absolute nuclear catastrophe that would irreversibly destroy the entire archive and all symbolic capacity, would destroy the movement of survival, what I call survivance, at the very heart of life. This absolute reference of all possible literature is on a par with the absolute effacement of any possible trace. It is thus the only ineffaceable trace. It is so as the trace of what is entirely other, trace du tout autre. This is the only absolute trace, effaceable, ineffaceable. This is the only subject of all possible literature, of all possible criticism. It's only ultimate and asymbolic reference, unsymbolizable, even unsignifiable. This is, if not the nuclear age, if not the nuclear catastrophe, at least that towards which nuclear discourse and the nuclear symbolic are still beckoning. The reminderless and asymbolic destruction of literature. Literature and literary criticism cannot speak of anything else. They can have no other ultimate reference. They can only multiply their strategic maneuvers in order to assimilate that unassimilable holy other. They are nothing but those maneuvers and that diplomatic strategy with the double talk that can never be reduced to them. For simultaneously, that subject of literature cannot be a nameable subject, nor that referent a nameable referent. then the perspective of nuclear war allows us to re-elaborate the question of the referent. What is a referent? In another way, to elaborate the question of the transcendental ego, transcendental subject, Husserl's phenomenology, needed at some point the fiction of a total chaos. Capable of speaking only of that, literature cannot help but speak of other things as well, and invent strategies for speaking of other things, for putting off the encounter with the holy other. An encounter with which, however, this relationless relation, this relation of incommensurability, cannot be wholly suspended, even though it is precisely its epochal suspension. This is the only invention possible. What I am saying can be transposed into a discourse of contemporary diplomatico-military strategy. Consider, for example, what Theodore Draper says in an article entitled How Not to Think About Nuclear War, July 15, 1982. In the early going, Draper has criticized the whole strategy of no first use of nuclear weapons, which would amount to no use. And he directed his irony at the, quote, realm of utopian obscurantism of Jonathan Schell, who, in The Fate of the Earth, spoke about, quote, reinventing politics and, quote, reinventing the world. I quote again, a global disarmament, both nuclear and conventional, and the invention of political means by which the world